WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are indeed tuned into Monday Night Talk, and happy Valentine's Day to you. I hope you and your significant other, your loved ones, have a chance to enjoy the day. Me, myself, actually had a chance to at least mortgage, at least spend my next two paychecks on candies and flour. Yes, it's gotten that expensive, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen. It's quite crazy. We got a great show lined up for you to help you get through your Valentine's Day evening. We're going to start things off in a political sense. Yes, it is. It is political season, and we have a couple of candidates for you this evening. We'll kick things off right after traffic with Rahsaan Hall. Rahsaan is actually a Democrat, and he is looking for your vote to hopefully be the next Plymouth County District Attorney. As you know... we have a Republican, Tim Cruz, is your incumbent. Rahsaan, I believe, is probably going to be one of a couple candidates that are going to be vying to be facing off against Tim come after the primary in September. Following that segment, we have a little NFL. Well, it's kind of an NFL-esque type of a segment. The only part of it is that we have a former NFL quarterback, Ron Jaworski, former quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles, also now a ESPN analyst. He's not coming on to talk about the Super Bowl. We're actually talking about that it is Heart Health Month. He is joined by Dr. David Strobel, and we'll talk about anybody who's ever experienced any heart ailments or stroke, and what you may need to do if, in fact, you have experienced this. Hour number two, again, back on the campaign trail, we're going to speak with Danielle Allen. Danielle is a Democrat, another Democrat, candidate for governor here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We'll get an idea as to why she feels that she has a shot to be able to come away with the Democratic nod and be able, hopefully, to be the next governor of the Commonwealth. We'll talk about many of the issues that are plausible for folks who want to pick the next person who's going to, you know, run our state for the next 4 years. So looking forward to that conversation. And then we'll close out the show with a gentleman who is a life coach and a best-selling author, Daniel Mengena. I'm going to mess this up a couple of times because the G is a hard G, and I want to say Mengena. And so if I happen to do it one or two times, you know it's actually Daniel Mengena. And we're going to talk with him in regards to money, finances, how we look at money. It's kind of a, these days, you know, how we look at our money and how we manage it, knowing that we're dealing with inflation. It's crazy. I mean, knowing that just a year ago, gas was a dollar less. Knowing that when you, like I joked at the top of the show, you know, I've already spent my next two paychecks on candy and flowers and a card because that's how expensive things have become. What, you want to be a better money manager? So what we'll do is we'll speak with Daniel about that. So that's coming up in just a few moments. And just a quick reminder also, if you miss any of our radio segments, easy enough for you to be able to go onto the WATD website and on the homepage, look for podcasts, look for the different shows, and we have the latest show up from last week, and we do our best to try to turn it around in a relatively quick manner in order for you to hear any of the particular shows.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We return for the first segment of Monday Night Talk. Joining us is Mr. Rahsaan Hall. He is a candidate for Plymouth County District Attorney. He is also the former director of the Racial Justice Program for the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, of Massachusetts. Mr. Hall, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Kevin.
First thing I would ask you, just to better inform all of our audiences, tell us a little bit about yourself briefly.
Sure. So as you mentioned in the opening, I'm the former director of the Racial Justice Program for the ACLU of Massachusetts. Prior to that, I served at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights in Boston as the deputy director. And before that, I was a prosecutor in the city of Boston for the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office. I was there for 8 years. I handled any number of gang, drug, gun, and homicide cases. I'm also an ordained reverend within the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and I live in the city of Brockton, the city of champions.
Is this your first run for political office?
It is. I've certainly been involved with politics from the advocacy perspective, but have never been involved as a candidate or worked on a campaign. So I've been learning a lot along the way, and in some respects building the bridge as we cross it, but have been receiving a lot of positive feedback and support as I go forward with this campaign.
Folks don't realize that there's a lot that goes into the process to consider running for office. What went into it for you to consider stepping down from your, being the director of the Racial Justice Program for the ACLU to running for Plymouth County District Attorney?
There were a lot of considerations, and thank you for asking about that, because I think that's one of the things that does not get a lot of attention. And I'll have to say it up front. I had to talk with my wife first and make sure that we were on the same page, that her level of comfort for running for this office in particular that deals with public safety was something that she was going to be comfortable with. I have, we have adult children, so the disruption to daily life would not be as significant for them, but that was something certainly worth considering in being concerned about income for the period of time that I would be running for office, because I had to leave my position at the ACLU because of an office policy that did not allow individuals who work there to run for public office. I would either have to resign or take a leave of absence. And then really considering the breadth and scope of Plymouth County and all of the people that I would have to connect with and touch base with and share my vision for what this office is. So those are a lot of the considerations that went into making the decision to run for Plymouth County District Attorney.
How do you feel that your work with the ACLU and your work with Suffolk County as an assistant district attorney has best prepared you to possibly be the next district attorney here in Plymouth County?
Well, first of all, my work as an assistant district attorney in Suffolk County gave me the firsthand experience about what it is the DA's office does and how much power and influence they have to impact people's lives. Everything from charging decisions to bail requests to sentencing recommendations, the decisions to appeal certain outcomes of the court, and even influence in front of the legislature. Having worked there for 8 years, years, I was in contact with both victims and survivors of crime, and so I understood the impact that harm and disruption in communities had on people's lives. But I also worked very closely with law enforcement to secure convictions for people who, against people who had caused harm and disrupted the community. And so having all of those experiences gave me some insight around the inner workings of the district attorney's office and the things that are important when we think about public safety. I think my role at the American Civil Liberties Union gave me a different perspective. From an advocacy perspective, really trying to push for evidence-based reforms that reduce the footprint of the criminal legal system, that yield less harmful results, and seeing how district attorneys were oppositional to some of those reforms that were being advocated for. I also had an opportunity to gain a greater appreciation for the protections of civil rights and civil liberties. That is primarily what the ACLU's advocacy has been about. And in particular, concerns around racial justice issues, understanding that there are certainly racial disparities within society, but the role of the district attorney and the criminal legal system more generally has often exacerbated or made worse those racial disparities. And a lot of my work was centered around trying to undo the injustices that led to those racial disparities and find the ways in which the criminal legal system more broadly could be used to dismantle some of those disparities.
It's interesting. This is the early part of your response. Basically, it was kind of a segue to my next question, which is just a few short years ago, you actually helped lead the ACLU, a particular campaign called What a Difference a DA Makes, which basically educated voters on campaigns for DA. Talk a little bit about putting that together to better inform and educate folks. And do you think that voters understand the role, the influence, and the power that a district attorney has?
Thanks for that, Kevin, question, Kevin. It's a really important program that we launched. Our advocacy at the ACLU had consistently come up against roadblocks from district attorneys when we were advocating for reforms that would reduce the harmful impacts of the criminal legal system. It was consistently district attorneys that would stand in the way. When we were advocating to address wrongful convictions from the drug laboratory scandal, it was district attorneys that were oppositional to that. In my own experience as an assistant district attorney, I understood the way that the decisions district attorneys made could have significant impact on people's lives, and in some instances derail people's lives. And so we understood that as advocates and myself as a former prosecutor, but we didn't have a good sense of how much the public understood about that. And so we did some polling, and we found out that 4 in 10 Massachusetts voters did not know that the district attorney was an elected position. And this isn't just Massachusetts residents. These are people who took the poll and said, I vote regularly. And 4 out of 10 of them didn't know the DA was an elected position. And over half of the voters didn't think that the district attorney had that much power, or that it didn't really matter who the DA was. But in focus groups, when we confronted voters with the information about the role, power, and influence that district attorneys have and all of the decisions they make that impact people's lives, 81% of voters said that they would pay more attention to the next district attorney election. And we saw, through our public education campaign, substantial increases in ballots cast in district attorney races. We saw something around the range of 38% increase in ballots cast in Suffolk County race. We saw up to 126% increase in ballots cast in the Berkshire County race. And so it really underscored how significant and important this role, how important and significant this role is, and how important it is for the voters to understand that and be informed and engaged in the process of not only voting for district attorney, but holding the district attorney accountable to the things that they desire and want to see in their community.
Do you feel that a part of the voter apathy in understanding the role of a district attorney has something to do with the number of layers of government and knowing that, especially here in Plymouth County, that a lot of folks disregard county government and they see it just that they, you know, knowing that a number of the counties no longer actually exist and have governance. That maybe folks aren't paying attention, or are there's kind of a misunderstanding?
I think it's a combination of things, and I think you're right to point out the lack of a county government structure. Many other states have county governance structures, and so people are engaged and in tune to what's happening at the county level, where in Massachusetts it's really just kind of like the sheriff, the DA, the register of deeds and the register of probate and county commissioners. But that doesn't impact people's day-to-day lives. And I think that's another thing that impacts how people understand the role or whether or not people pay attention, is that unless you've been a victim of a crime or been charged with a crime or had a family or a family member or loved one who's been a victim or charged with a crime, there's very little interaction with the system that a lot of people have. And so therefore, it's not top of mind. Unfortunately, a lot of decisions get made by DA's offices. A lot of things happen in DA's offices. And if it's not, a national media market, it probably doesn't get the type of coverage that would make people pay attention to it. And so when it comes to the election and people see the ballot and say, hey, I've never been victimized by crime and I've never felt like the system has done me wrong, seems like everything's okay, they're either not going to vote because they don't have enough information, or they're just going to continue to cast the ballot for whoever's name is on the ballot. And that's not the best way for a democracy to operate.
What are you hearing from voters early on since you have announced that you're a candidate for district attorney? What are voters saying to you? What are their concerns? What do you feel are the real true issues that they're bringing forth?
I've received a lot of support from voters and the people that I've been engaging with throughout the county, from Hull to Halifax, from Plymouth, Plimpton, Pembroke, Brockton, and the Bridgewaters, and all of the 27 municipalities within the county. There's been a lot of excitement about my candidacy, about a more fair and just system. People are wanting to see the racial disparities addressed in the system. And also people want to feel that they will be kept safe. And there is an emerging understanding based on some of the national conversations, issues around racial justice, and even evidence and research that shows that there are better ways to get better, safer, and healthier outcomes for our community through using harm reduction approaches and moving away from the tough on crime and law and order rhetoric that's really going to make a difference. And I've received a lot of enthusiasm around the messaging that I'm running to reclaim the spirit of justice and restore a sense of integrity and transparency and professionalism to the district attorney's office. And so those are some of the concerns and response and feedback that I've heard from the residents and voters of Plymouth County.
What are your thoughts on the ongoing opioid epidemic crisis? And what would your office continue to do in efforts to educate and help reduce folks who are overdosing and dying?
The opioid crisis is a problem and is no respecter of person. It has ravaged communities across the country and Plymouth County in particular. And a lot of law enforcement officials in particular have acknowledged that we cannot arrest, prosecute, or incarcerate our way out of this problem. Unfortunately, a lot of people continue to pursue the tactics and strategies that require arresting, prosecuting, and incarcerating our way out of the opioid crisis. This is a public health issue, and it needs to be treated as such. And so, if elected district attorney, I would continue to partner with some of the organizations on the ground that are doing good work to provide treatment and services to people. But I would also push the envelope and really encourage us to look at more harm reduction approaches to dealing with the opioid crisis. Incarceration is not the solution for people who are struggling with substance use disorder. And there's data to back that up. I would partner and work with medical addiction specialists to find out what are the interventions that are going to make the best, that are going to increase the likelihood that someone has a better outcome from being involved in this system, even if it means not being involved in this system at all. I would use the platform of district attorney to make sure that our community are getting the types of resources to abate the issue and concerns and make sure that people's needs are being met. But I just can't fathom doubling down on the failed war on drugs that has left many communities in shambles, particularly black and brown communities. It's not lost on me that when heroin and crack cocaine were epidemics in black and brown communities, the immediate response was that of criminalizing that behavior and the war, further escalating the war on drugs. And now that the opioid crisis is impacting a broader swath of community and doing much more harm and damage in white and suburban communities, that there's a greater openness to approaching this as a public health crisis. That said, what happened in the past has happened in the past, and we need to learn lessons from that. And one of the greatest lessons that we can learn from that is that we shouldn't continue to criminalize substance use issues and addiction.
What would you say your stance is regarding mandatory minimum sentences? When is this method or this tool, depending on the criminal case, should a mandatory minimum sentencing be used?
Mandatory minimum sentences are a significant problem within the criminal legal system because it takes the discretion away from judges who are supposed to be the neutral arbiters of a case. They are the ones who are supposed to hear all of the evidence and don't have a stake in the outcome other than making sure that justice is served. And when mandatory minimums are on the table, all of the power is exclusively in the province of the prosecutor. Perfect case, for example, when I was an assistant district attorney, I had a case of a young African-American man, 18 years old, was charged with possession of a Class D substance, which was marijuana, with the intent to distribute within a certain distance of a park. That carried a mandatory minimum sentence, a 2-year jail sentence. The only thing that I was given the permission to do was to agree to dismiss the mandatory sentence only if he agreed to a 2-year suspended sentence. And so what that meant for that young man is if he agreed to that, he would have a 2-year jail sentence hanging over his head for 2 years. And if he violated, he would immediately go to jail. And he had no prior criminal history. And his mother, who was there with him in the court, said, "We'll take it," because for her, it meant her son wasn't going to have to go to jail. But I have no idea what happened to that young man. And now we're in Massachusetts, where we have a burgeoning cannabis industry, and the people who are generating the greatest amount of wealth from this look nothing like that 18-year-old African-American man. And so it's unfair and it's unjust for prosecutors to have all of that power and to be able to leverage that power to either get guilty pleas and sentences out of people that may not be the most appropriate sentence, or to take the discretion away from a judge to make the decision about what is the best sentence for someone. And so mandatory minimums have been misused, abused, and until there is some other way of ensuring that there is fairness across the board, they shouldn't be used.
What is it that, again, if you're elected, what is it that your office can do to at least try to find a better way to use a mandatory minimum if it is at all applicable, whether it's somebody who is a violent offender or someone who is a sexual predator?
I think in instances like that, and with all cases, there should be a case-by-case evaluation and considering public safety concerns. But this one-size-fits-all approach, where every time someone is arguably charged with a mandatory minimum sentence, that minimum mandatory sentence has to be enforced, is what has led to mass incarceration in our community. The lack of discernment and discretion in many district attorney's offices have sent people away to prison for exorbitant sentences. The punishment is not in proportion to the harm. Now, when you look at people who have created significant harm in communities and have been involved in extremely violent behavior, I think there is a case for mandatory minimum sentences. But even then, we have to look at what are the outcomes that we get, because with a mandatory minimum sentence, those people are ultimately coming home. And one of the things that a lot of people don't recognize is that mandatory minimum sentences impact a person's ability to get good time. So the motivation to curtail your behavior while you're incarcerated is taken away because there's a mandatory minimum. So there's no way to reduce the sentence. It impacts a person's ability to receive a furlough and come out into community under supervision. And so we really have to be thoughtful about how that blunt tool is used to keep our community safe in a way that doesn't exacerbate the underlying problems that led to either that individual or other people in community creating harm in the first place.
You're just joining us. Our guest today is Rahsaan Hall. He is a Democrat for Plymouth County District Attorney, and we're chatting with him about his campaign for office. I know in the past, from some of my research, you praised former Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins for her decision to not prosecute a series of nonviolent misdemeanors. Some of those would include trespassing, shoplifting, possession of drugs. If elected, would you make a similar decision for Plymouth County and not prosecute for certain misdemeanors?
I think it's important to point out with then-District Attorney Rollins, now U.S. Attorney Rollins, that her policy memo that laid out those 15 crimes that she would not prosecute, that it was presumptive non-prosecution, that it was not an absolute that those offenses would not be prosecuted. And another important aspect to consider is that some of those offenses were the highest drivers of racial disparities in the system. And research has been shown that a lot of those offenses, Black and Latinx people were disproportionately charged with those offenses. It doesn't mean that they were committing those offenses more than white people. It just means that they were in communities that were policed more and that there was a greater likelihood that they would be charged and arrested or arrested and charged and prosecuted for those offenses. And I think it's important to understand some of the motivations behind that. It's also important to think about the precious resources that the taxpayers have given the district attorney's office to address harm and disruption and crime in our communities, and evaluate what makes the most sense for the limited precious resources that our taxpayers have given us, that we spend our time and efforts on. When we think about some of the violent and horrific crimes that happen in community, and then we think about the majority of the cases that come through our district courts, where a lot of those offenses are, there's a disequilibrium in how much resources are spent. And so I certainly look at a list of presumptive non-prosecution offenses that, one, lead to significant racial disparities, and two, clog up the courts with offenses that do not pose an immediate threat of physical harm or impact to public safety.
And has this been successful? I mean, while it was initially, folks were not, it was not a popular opinion, I believe that it has been somewhat successful in Suffolk County, has it not?
It actually has. And here's one of the other things, Kevin, and thank you for asking that question, is separate and apart from people's anecdotes, right, and the fear-mongering of, you know, the worst-case scenario and the slippery slopes. If you don't prosecute shoplifters, then there's going to be a run on small businesses, and no one will ever respect the law because everybody's just going to be shoplifting because they know that they won't be prosecuted. And one, that's not true. I have more faith in humanity that people are not going to take advantage of situations when they feel like they're not going to be held accountable for it. People have a code and morals and beliefs and principles that prevent them from doing that in the first place. Mm-hmm. And second, it's important to understand that that there was empirical research that backed up that the people who were not charged with these offenses were less likely to come back into court. And so by prosecuting those low-level offenses, it complicated people's lives, and they were more likely to be rearrested. But by diverting them out of the system, either dismissing those cases or offloading them into other programs, people did not reappear or get rearrested. And I think that's an important lesson for us when we think about, again, those precious resources that the taxpayers of the Commonwealth have given us to discern what is the best and highest use of these resources. And I would say that presumptive non-prosecution of these low-level nonviolent offenses is not only makes good sense, but it is it's backed up by empirical data and research that shows that it makes sense.
If elected, what would you feel are some of the top priorities that you would have for the district attorney's office upon taking office?
I would prioritize taking a harm reduction approach to issues related to substance use disorder and mental health issues, increasing transparency in the office's policies, practices, and prosecution data. I would minimize the use of the office's precious resources on minor low-level offenses that clog up the courts and increase the likelihood that people stay entangled in this system. I'd work to reduce racial disparities through data collection, analysis, and reporting. I would develop an integrity bureau that oversees every aspect of prosecution, not just conviction integrity. And I would develop a robust training and management infrastructure that ensures that the office is operating with the highest levels of professionalism and integrity. I think that is what justice demands, and I think that's what the residents of Plymouth County deserve.
Anything that I haven't asked you during our conversation here, but that you'd like to take a moment to at least touch upon?
I think it's important for your listeners to understand that justice, because I have often spoken about the criminal legal system as opposed to the criminal justice system. And when you look at the significant racial disparities and the number of wrongful convictions and the disparities in unsolved violent crimes, it's hard to call it a system of justice, but it is certainly a system of laws. And it is important for people to understand that justice is not defined by archaic notions of being tough on crime or promoting the idea that law enforcement officials exclusively through their aggressive and inflexible tactics keep us safe. Justice is ensuring people's underlying needs are met so that they don't come in contact contact with the system, and that their involvement with the system produces less harmful, if not better, outcome for communities. The residents of Plymouth County deserve a district attorney's office that operates with the highest levels of accountability and integrity, and one that will treat victims and survivors of crime with dignity and respect, and carry out the duties of the office with transparency, reduce those disparities in the criminal legal systems, and engage our communities. And that's what I pledge to do if elected as the next Plymouth County district attorney. And so I hope your listeners are encouraged to support my candidacy. To find out more information, they can go to my website, hallfordA.com. That's Hall, the number four, DA.com. I'll be having also a launch event, a virtual launch event next Wednesday, the 16th, at 6:30 p.m. We'll make sure that there's more information on our social media that people can log on and register for that.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us and sharing details about your campaign, and hopefully we'll have more conversations down the road somewhere.
Thank you so much, Devin. I appreciate you. Take care.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I am so stressed out. The school, home, bills, government, economy, gas prices, vaccines. It is so hard to get anything done and so stressful. We are all stretched to the max with no end in sight. We're all saying the same thing to one another. This is crazy. I'm not the bringer of bad news. I bring good news. And the good news is we're all in this together. And I actually find comfort in that. So let's all take these stress-relieving, mindful breaths together. Don't change the channel. Shh. Take a breath. I'm inhaling. I'm exhaling.
Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we are back for yet another segment here on Monday Night Talk. Joining us is former NFL quarterback Ron Jaworski, who is tackling more than just football during Heart Health Month in February. And while Ron is best known for football and as an ESPN commentator, he's also the host of a health education podcast called True to Your Heart. Now, through his role, Ron has learned much more about cardiovascular disease and issues surrounding it. Now, with Ron is cardiologist Dr. David Strobel, who has some important information for patients who have already had a heart attack or stroke and their caregivers. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin.
Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. So, while I am very much interested, Ron, in some of the things that you are working on, some of your projects, as someone who loves football and a New England Patriots fan, I'm more interested in hearing your thoughts about Tom Brady retiring from NFL after 22 years.
If anyone doesn't love Tom Brady, they don't understand football. You know, Tom will go down as the greatest quarterback ever to play the game and the greatest player ever to play the game. I was fortunate through my broadcasting career to spend time with Tom Brady and kind of learn what makes that guy tick. And he's a highly motivated individual. His only goal in life was to be great. And he was. So, you know, we're all better people. The league is better because of guys like Tom Brady and the way he played the game. So, you know, I hope he has a great future after his retirement, and I'm sure he will.
Yeah, I definitely couldn't agree with you more. And let's get right into the meat and potatoes. Again, Tom, somebody who worried about his health. We're here to talk about health. How did you get involved in the True to Your Heart podcast, and what have you learned from it?
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate to join another great team, the Amron team, and True to Your Heart podcast, and host the show. And, you know, over the last 7 or 8 months, we've had some of the most incredible guests you could ever imagine that really understand what heart disease is all about. And February is Heart Healthy Month. So, you know, our job was really, and my job was, you know, to throw touchdown passes, to educate the people listening to our podcast on how to take care of your body and how to be heart healthy. And I learned so much from the guests that I had on the show. You're going to be hearing from Dr. Strobel in a few minutes. People like Dr. Strobel educated me and our listening audience on TrueToYourHeart.com podcast. It was a phenomenal experience for me. And in fact, we had so much fun and educated so many people. We're going to be back next year with another series of podcasts. So I'm really, really excited about that. And, you know, as a former player, you know, you have people tripping all over to make sure you're in shape. You know, athletic trainers, nutritionists, doctors, you know, they're always on you. But as you get away from the game, you got to take care of yourself. And at that point, you must develop a game plan with your doctor for yourself. And, you know, as I've reached an older age, I'm now more concerned about exercise, diet, what I'm eating. You know, I take my blood pressure every day. I'm weighing myself every day. Now, I must admit, I have one little vice, and it's I like a cigar every once in a while. I'm on the golf course, so I'm trying to eliminate that one. But, you know, when I make a birdie, I seem to light up a cigar all the time. But other than that, you know, I'm following doctor's orders. I have a plan, and hopefully that plan will be successful.
I believe, Doctor, that Ron has handed the ball off to you, as he mentioned you, working with you. What should people know who have had a heart attack or stroke when it comes to potential increased risk?
Yeah, Kevin, that's the bad news, that if you're fortunate enough to survive a heart attack, you still have a very increased risk of having another cardiovascular event over that next year in particular. In fact, studies have shown that up to 50% of people that have had a heart attack will experience some other cardiovascular event, such as another heart attack, a stroke, a cardiovascular procedure in the next year. So up to 50% in 1 year. It's a very significant risk. And as Ron was pointing out, we have to have a game plan to attack that. We have some therapies that can lower LDL cholesterol, which is important. That's the bad guy cholesterol. So as Ron mentioned, the cornerstones of diet and exercise, but some people genetically have a predisposition to having higher cholesterol levels. But even those patients that are treated aggressively still have this persistent increased cardiovascular risk. And that's where I think Ron would agree. You got a great offense has to be complemented by a great defense. So yep. The offense might be driving down that cholesterol, but the defense is looking for warning signs, looking for clues that might point out that patient that has that persistent increased cardiovascular risk. And then it's important to, as Ron pointed out, develop that game plan to approach that so we can anticipate and then try to eliminate that second cardiovascular event.
Is it important when you're talking about a game plan, Doctor, at least understanding your family's health history and if there is heart disease or issues with your heart through other members in your family?
Kevin, that's an excellent point. We're a mix between our genes and how we live, as Ron pointed out.
Mm.
And so family history is always something that gets my attention. And I look for other genetic traits that may, high blood pressure, as Ron mentioned, other risk cardiac risk factors, a tendency towards higher blood sugars or diabetes, and looking at their blood fats. So these are all important things to take into account.
Could we also talk?
Hey, Kevin?
Yes, please, Ron.
Kevin, if I could chime in 1 second, about 6 months ago, my brother passed away to heart disease. And it's really put me on a mission to learn about myself, my hereditary traits, but also to let people know that you can prevent heart attacks. You can prevent heart disease. So that's why I love doing this podcast. It's even more meaningful to me now that I can spread the word and get the word out there that by doing the right thing, you'll be better off.
Did you have, besides your brother, having heart disease, have you had other family members, Ron? Did you learn about this?
There have not been, but I still now have, done some research talking to, cousins, aunts, uncles, those people that are still alive that can give me some insight. And fortunately, nothing has popped up. It was just my brother had the heart disease.
Sorry about your brother's passing, Ron.
Well, I appreciate your condolences. Thank you.
So, doctor, I would ask you, treatments. What are the options for people who are at higher risk?
Kevin, another great question. It's important to individualize that treatment plan, of course. Every case is different. So it's important to have that dialogue with your physician and to be a Pro Bowl quarterback. You have to empower yourself to know your opponent, know about heart disease, know about potential treatments. TrueToYourHeart.com is an excellent resource for patients, and I encourage patients, don't wait, don't put it off on the calendar. I think Ron's brother tells us the story that we have to have some urgency about this. We're on the goal line, and the 2-minute warning has hit, and we don't want to fumble. We want to have a winning game plan. So these can be individualized. But I think what's very important is to again be your best advocate. Go with questions. Your loved ones can come with you, but have that discussion with the doctor or healthcare provider to come up with what is an individualized plan for you.
Ron, I'll ask you. What are some final thoughts that you want to share with our audience that they should remember about this particular issue?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple. I know I've mentioned already, and Dr. Strobel's mentioned, have a game plan. And that's the most important thing. Communication with your doctor, any symptoms that you may have, communicate with your doctor, but have a plan. Set aside time, take time, and put that plan together.
And if folks want to hear the podcast that you gentlemen do, that you do, Ron, how can they do that? Where can they find that media?
TrueToYourHeart.com. I'll say it again because it's very important. TrueToYourHeart.com. I've got when I do my podcast, I have great guests on the show. We all get educated.
Well, I want to thank you, Ron, and I want to thank you, Dr. Strobel, for sharing this important information. We all know, we've all experienced someone in our family or someone close to us who has had heart issues. So I feel that this particular conversation that we're having here today, especially during Heart Health Month, is very important.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
We will step aside, closing out hour number one. When we come back, hour number two here at 95.9 WATD.
WATD FM Marshfield, WMEX Quincy, WBMS Brockton, and Translator W266DA Brockton. This is the South Shores Radio Station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
That truck, it pays?
What?
The bumper sticker on that truck says it pays.
Pays? Pays what?
I can't quite read it. Oh, it pays to stay way back.
Ah, what was that?
The truck! Snap back a rock! Now I've got a broken windshield.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny and Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. It pays to stay way back. However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINYS. And thank you.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
It is the season for campaigning here in the state of Massachusetts. And you'll see there'll be a series of conversations that we will be hosting over the next few months with different candidates. Joining us is a candidate for governor, a gubernatorial candidate. We have Danielle Allen, who wants your vote as a Democrat for governor. Danielle, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. It is great to be here with you. Glad. Thank you for having me.
So let's start out with just a little, just a general overview of yourself. Tell the folks a little bit about yourself.
Sure. My students call me Prof Al, and I've been called all kinds of dean and director and chairman of the board, but my favorite title is mom, and next best to that is just plain Yao. I am a nonprofit leader, democracy advocate, and a national voice, leadership voice, pandemic response. I have a day job as a professor and director at Harvard to answer a call to service. It's a dark, hard, it's not a time for business as usual. We've got to find a path out and lay a foundation for healthy communities, a healthy, healthy democracy.
So it's worth asking, have you ever had the or ever thought of being elected or appointed to a municipal board or an office?
Been appointed in Illinois. I served on the Illinois State Humanities when I was on the faculty of Chicago. These were in the 1997 and 2007. And I have worked with elections at all levels. For example, I jumped in on pandemic response. And my team, a big network of some practitioners and mayors from around the country and community advocates, put together the first national policy roadmap in April 2020, ramp up of public investment in tests. And we worked with the United States Conference of Mayors. We worked with members, both parties, both houses. I co-authored legislation with Senator Sin Cassidy and worked with mayors around the country and governors around the country. I've spent a career working behind on policy and then serving in a point of context, but also nonprofit sector, leading a $6 billion mission, leading a $60 million division at the University of Chicago, and leading national boards.
What led your decision to run for governor here in Massachusetts?
It's just not a time for business as usual. The truth is, in my life, it hasn't been a time for business as usual since 2009. I lost my younger cousin, Michael, here. Michael was probably the baby I ever held when he was born in 79. I was a lonely kid being bullied on the school playground that year and delivered a ready-made new best friend. Michael was a beautiful kid with a mind full of curiosity to travel the world and learn French. Out of that, in 1995, he was arrested in Southern California on arrest for an attempted carjacking. This is a terrible thing to have done. It was also a time in California when punishment was at its most intense. On that first arrest, Michael got a sentence of 12 years and 8 months. And from the age of 15, he served 12. So he, you know, when he got out, what I always call cousin on duty, trying to help with thing and school and jobs and the like, help together. And Michael had 2 years out, 2 years of freedom. On that first arrest, Michael got assaulted by somebody he had met while he was in prison. And I had a deep sense of personal fear about Michael's death, but I was beating my head against the question of why are we so bad at helping so many young people transition to a healthy adulthood? And at the opioid epidemic, and we see it's young people backgrounds. And so I've been putting every disposal to work since then, trying to put the world to rights for young people. Pandemic hit, it just all seems so much worse. So home for all of us that it's not a time for business at all. So it was really the pandemic. I'm gonna young transition to a healthy adulthood. Thing else, we've got to do so much more for our families who are affected by the opioid epidemic, families who are struggling through the pandemic, build the foundations for healthy communities and healthy lives.
What do you feel sets you apart from other candidates that have announced their desire to be the next?
You know, I think we have to just pause for a second and take stock of what an exciting moment this is in the Commonwealth. Here in the Democratic primary, we've got three women for governor, and so there's a strong that Massachusetts could elect a woman as governor for the first time in its history. It's really exciting to be a part of that. It really is exciting to be a part of a field that's bringing different perspectives and voices in. My colleagues' race bring a variety of skill sets and backgrounds. Senator Chang Diaz brings which legislative history. The Attorney General brings a distinguished history as a law enforcement officer. I bring 20 years of leadership and executive experience from the nonprofit sector. So I bring a fresh perspective, a perspective that's been about on how policy areas of health and education and the economy together, how to connect the dots. So, you know, it's really that outside perspective as a law enforcement officer. You have to choose, you know, which skills, body of experience meets the challenges of the moment. I believe that fresh is what we need in these hard times.
If folks are just tuning in, we are speaking with Danielle, and she is a candidate for governor. She is a Democrat. You've mentioned it just a few minutes ago, talking about COVID. How big of a role will COVID play in some of the issues that will be discussed out on the campaign trail and amongst other candidates?
I think it's going to be a critical issue. I mean, you know, look, folks really struggling. We've all felt the impact. I've got an 11-year-old and a 10-year-old, you know, man, remote school hard. I watched my poor son, his academic just decline. And I worked really hard to try to accelerate for safe and healthy in-person learning safety for our learners and for our education staff. So I just think, you know, we've all been through so much, quite settled yet. It's clear that transition point. We now have it as an endemic disease. So in that regard, it is time for us to recognize that we'll have a sort of steady level and we may have surges. And it's just like other event. You know, when a snowstorm's coming, get those warnings out. We have visions we take. We ask folks cars off the street, for example. And then when the weather event passes, you get cars back on the street. And so in the same way, we've got to get to a pattern. We've got regulation. Watch out, asserting, it's time to use masks again. It's time for us to take some of our other precautions. Okay, now the surge has receded. We're back to taking care of our individuals for individual health and safety.
Taking a look at your website, allen4ma.com, major issues aren't necessarily identified, but instead they're listed as agendas. What is that, and what are some of the important agendas that you're going to look to tackle if elected?
Well, the first agenda is housing, right? That started with. And the reason that is because I got started in this work in December of 2020. I began an exploratory process to make a judgment about whether it was the right to run for this office. And a piece of my exploration was to run a listening tour around the Commonwealth. So when I started, that has an issue in the Commonwealth. I learned that it is the single most entailed pain point across the whole state. We've got young families leaving just because they can't get a foothold in the property. And we have other families who are renters, you know, with skyrocketing, who are having to move from year to year, and real problems with affordability. And elder folks, seniors, who that terrible dilemma, stay in a community they've been in for decades and love, or be in a place they can afford and maintain. So we have a lot of our folks living in the woods, on Martha's Vineyard, also in Massachusetts. We really have to dynamic on that one. A roof over every head. It's got to be a core commitment.
I think probably one of the biggest problems when it comes to housing, as it has been mentioned for many years, is having proper housing stock. But then you have 40B, which is supposed to be affordable housing. Do you feel that those are items that you want the housing agenda will look to address?
Absolutely. I mean, we've got to get enough supply of affordable housing. It is about housing stock. We do all need tenant protections, things like counsel in cases of eviction. Mm-hmm. So we've got to work on both fronts. Lots of times people think it's either or. Either you're on zoning reform so you can get that affordable or abundant supply of affordable housing, or you're going to work on tenant protections. They both end. And I'm about solutions, technology. That's a really important thing. And we can get parts of the solution set from different parts of the policy landscape, in all honesty. So yes, we've got to work on that high. And I think the way to do that with a requirement at the level of this, every town and city can participate by selecting a zoning overlay, an affordable overlay from a menu of options. So we're designing a policy that is asking everybody to step up, but that is decision-making authority in the hands of municipalities. So that choice every town and city made.
Where does healthcare amongst your agendas?
Absolutely. No, it's sort of the critical goal. So we have a set of building blocks, you know, the bits of healthy communities, and that includes housing, and it includes transportation so folks can get to jobs and the good jobs and good schools and safety for all, you know, making sure that approaches to policing, approach responding to mental health events that are really about the safety of all. And so those are building blocks. Our goals are an economy that's dynamic and inclusive across the Commonwealth, and health across the whole Commonwealth. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think we all want the same thing in relationship to her. We all want universal, simple, affordable access to high care and high quality foundation health. Our health agenda, both those pieces, the foundations for health and access to that high quality and treatment when you are struggling with things. Universal, simple, affordable, that's the goal. And we've got some specifics, for example, supporting investment in insurance policies for businesses to lower the burden that small businesses are currently bearing for insurance. There's some other things I could talk about, but the overall goal is getting to universal, simple, and affordable.
Are you a proponent of the health connector and all been able to do to get folks to connect with affordable health care?
I am a proponent of the health. I think it has succeeded. I think it's doing a good job. We still have 3% of folks to date who are not covered, and so proposals to close that coverage gap.
Proponent of the health connector. And
even pain points where cover is really expensive and costs are rising. And the pain point is really most fear for small business owners, ease of small businesses. So we do have some reforms in mind that are meant to bring that burden down for folks, small business community.
Recently, the Allen campaign released your potential changes that would be when it comes to substance use and recovery. Would you provide some details?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think at this point we all are just so painfully clear on how the opioid epidemic has wrought pain and devastation to families across the Commonwealth. Across the whole of the Baker-Pluto administration, we've seen 5 people a day dying of overdose deaths. And no improvement, and right numbers are getting worse. So nibbling at the edges of responding to the need that so many Massachusetts families have. And I believe it's time to really to do the whole job, the whole work of providing the resources for that are necessary. That beds for substance use disorder. For example, in Western Massachusetts, we just don't have a sufficient supply of substance use treatment beds. So it means removing the barriers to treatment and the barriers to the onward journey of, you know, getting the housing that you need, supportive housing, access to employment and jobs. And the single greatest barrier, right, exists to recovery and health and protecting people from overdose, the single greatest barrier, the stigma that comes from the causation of addiction. So I believe the time is here for us to reify simple use and offenses of controlled substance as civil issues, felony issues, not criminal, a civil fine, and then a fine that could be waived if people are ready to a recovery journey. The model here comes from Oregon. The Oregon passed this kind of classification policy by ballot proposition in 2020, and I believe Massachusetts is the next leader in the country. We're giving people help, not handcuffs.
Do you feel that the pandemic kind of, there was progress being made with substance abuse and helping those folks who needed the field. The pandemic kind of regressed any of the progress that was made by the Commonwealth?
You know, again, so much different kind of difficulty in the pandemic, and we've all felt it. There are some ways in which the pandemic was a setback for folks dealing with substance use disorder challenges.
Of regressed any
facilities too. So for me, we're seeing numbers of opioid overdose deaths increase, and we all know the toll that the pandemic has taken. So it has been really hard, and we're suffering in families across the Commonwealth. At the same time, the pandemic did mean that people had access to telehealth for substance use disorder issues, and there was some flexibility around the use of methadone. We're able to use methadone in a home suffering in families across the Commonwealth. And that actually improved outcomes. It was a kind of accidental experiment, and people could see that, in fact, people use methadone in a home-based context to increase overdoses from methadone at all. So in that regard, we made new solutions that can help strengthen the power of that recovery journey that have been discovered as a result of it.
Again, if you are tuning in, we are speaking with Allen. She is a Democrat for governor, looking for your vote. Danielle, you know, voters, a lot of times when they go into the voting booth, one of the first things they vote with is their pocketbooks. And when it comes to cost of living and how much more is it going to cost them, depending on whose administration is in office. What will your administration do when it comes to being careful to raising taxes and fees?
Yeah. No, I mean, we've got to get the cost of living down and the life up. That's the key. And taxes are an important part of that. So first, just to say, though, you got to get housing costs down. Getting housing costs down is another important leaving people's pocketbooks. In terms of taxes, you know, we have to invest in the path to prosperity in Massachusetts. And I believe it's time to pay their fair share. So I am a fair share amendment. And this amendment brings in a surcharge on average weekly greater than $20,000. So if you make up to $20,000, you pay 5% taxes like everybody else. If you make more than $20,000, on the extra dollars above the fair share amendment, additional 4% surcharge. Surcharge on average week. So in early education, ages 0 to 5, that is a way of building a childcare system and bringing affordability. So that's a place where it's lowering costs, right? It's helping out the of working families across the country to build out that early education or system. Also, investments would go into transportation. And if folks can commute comfortably and efficiently between home and home is more affordable, then work the book out with those housing and transportation and early education policies. Everybody across the Commonwealth is pitching in and voting more than $20,000 a week are being asked right now to step up a little bit more.
It's worth noting that, you know, we've touched on COVID a couple times during our conversation here, and it's well known that with the ARPA, which is the American Rescue Plan Act, put forth by the Biden administration, President Biden, if you're elected, well, what's the thought as far as overseeing the expenditure of those $4 to $5 billion that the Commonwealth is going to get over the next 4 to 5 years?
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, we've been through such hard times, and here we are, a moment of extraordinary opportunity. I'll tell you, I am a historian by training originally, so I'm always full of historical examples and comparison. The moment we're in reminds me of the end of World War II, to be honest. So at the end of World War II, the U.S. had a budget surplus, and with that budget surplus, we didn't actually give it back. We didn't give it back in the form of tax breaks. What we did was invest in the infrastructure of a free and prosperous Europe. We did that because we knew that that investment would be more prosperous and protect our freedom over time. I believe that's the same place we're in now with the ARPA. We have a chance to invest in ourselves, invest in shared prosperity, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. As I've been traveling around the state, visiting and city leaders, I have to say I've heard something over again. What I've heard is we don't really know what the state's going to do with these funds. We're going to do our own planning. We don't know if we should have water infrastructure, if we should have our road infrastructure, you know, systems, because we're not sure what they're doing. My number one commitment about our ARPA funds would be to achieve effective strategic coordination between state government and towns so that we don't have to reinvent the people duplicating effort, but we can figure what's the state taking on statewide and then what are municipalities doing on so that we can really renovate our infrastructure and get ready for a phase of shared prosperity and quality of life.
Now, you wanted briefly that, you know, you've been traveling around the state talking with municipal leaders. I'm sure you've had conversations with voters. What are some of the other things that are concerning them and that they would hope that whoever's elected governor next, make sure that they are taken care of?
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that question, Kevin. And it relates to, you asked, we have agendas listed there. It's because I have been traveling around the country, and our agendas are built out of what we've heard, all right? And our priority order is built out of what we've heard, too. So I came first because that's what we were hearing. And transportation came second. That's what we were hearing. And it's just very clear there is a real need for in infrastructure. And got to do that to get past the economy where we have both in the Boston area, but other parts of the state with a contracting economy, infrastructure investments, support this formation all across the Commonwealth goal here. Now, those are top priorities. We've heard a heck of schools as well, it's got to be said. The economy where we have, I think, isn't frustrated with what we've last 2 years with the impact of schools. And boy, educators too, you know, their morale is just so low, are so exhausted and stretched. So we have a lot of work to do to a place where families, educators, and staff and learners all like we're pulling together our one Commonwealth to help schools. And boy, educators.
Something that I want to touch upon before we wrap things up. And that is you also have climate as an agenda. Yep. What are some of the concerns in regards to climate? The first thing I can think of, knowing that we're close to the coast, would be any rising sea issues and any storm if you are a coastal community.
Absolutely. No, for sure. We are incredibly vulnerable to climate. And thank you for raising that. I should have said that as well. Yes, on our listening tour, we heard a lot of nervousness about climate. And it has to be said, we hear this from young people.
If you are a coastal community.
You know, I mean, stories I've heard from young people who their parents, you know, look, and thank you for raising that. I should have not started a family because I don't actually have confidence in our future. So the sort of fear goes so, and it's well grounded. I mean,
if you are a coastal community.
With rising seas here in Massachusetts. So our climate agenda, you know, one of the really good news is that we do have some good recent, the Next Generation Climate Roadmap. We have had important investments in wind It is time for us to really complement that with as aggressive investments in solar energy. And we also really have to support all efforts at resilience. The plan coastal communities are doing. Plymouth, amazing model. They've been doing careful work around water and also the question of for properties on the coast, how should we think about their future? And it's really that state government be reinforcing local planning efforts. Coastal communities are doing. Plymouth.
Other than asking you to information for folks to find out more about you, I call this the blank check question, where I sign my name, but you can, whatever I haven't asked you for a question that you want to kind of put forth an answer, feel free. Is there anything we haven't out, but you want to take a couple of moments to at least address during this conversation?
Absolutely. I really appreciate that, Kevin. I'll tell you, there's one question that's really on every mind when they hear that I'm running for governor. They think, what, a professor? A professor, a governor? How does that make sense at all? And so the short of it, I carry the title of professor, and I have been a leader in the face of nonprofit organizations through the whole of my career. So leading a $6 division at the age of 32 is my first leadership job, and then stepping up to lead a $6 billion nation that funds in the space of culture and has a larger philanthropic budget than the combined total of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Professor is a funny label that you have a real chance to drive change, complicated bureaucracies inside this space of colleges and universities. And in doing that, I've also crossed policy spaces. This matter is, I've been a person driving change behind the scenes for my whole career. It's different now that I'm stepping out in, because I believe it's not a time as usual.
And as we wrap up, our guest has been Danielle Allen. She is a candidate for governor. She's a Democrat. If folks want to find out more about you, your campaign, how can they do that?
You can learn more at allen4ma.com. That's allenforma.com. Very excited to be building a big guts and grit and heart and hustle. Come on out and join us.
We want to thank you so much for being our guest on this program.
Thank you, Kevin. It's been great talking with you.
We'll be back in just a moment. You are tuned in to talk here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Now, the Old Colony Elder Services Tip of the Month for February. OCES reminds you to protect yourself and others from the COVID-19 virus by getting vaccinated. It lessens the risk of severe illness and death. Wear a mask in public places. Social distance. Avoid large gatherings. And wash your hands often. If you develop symptoms or have questions about getting tested for COVID-19, contact your primary care physician or refer to cdc.gov.
I'm Nicole Long, CEO at Old Colony Elder Services. Finding a family member the personalized care they deserve can be a challenge. Our OCES staff is a local and reliable resource that can provide the information you may be looking for about important services for older adults and individuals with disabilities. OCES offers a number of in-home care options and can link your family member with the service provider needed. Call OCES at 508-584-1561 or visit OCESMA.org.
Download previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We have arrived at the final segment of this week's Monday Night Talk. Joining us today, we are going to talk a little bit about money. Today's day and age, especially here in 2022, a lot of us are looking at our wallets and going, oh my goodness, do I have enough to be able to put enough gas in my vehicle, to go out and go grocery shopping, to be able to at least save and get by? What is our money doing for us? And maybe, you know, if we do have money, what are we doing with it? And how to think when it comes to money? Well, joining us is a gentleman who is a Forbes-featured international speaker, top 10 life coaches of 2021, also best-selling author of Stepping Beyond Intention. We have Mr. Daniel Mangena. Did I say that right, Daniel?
It's Gena, but...
We got the first name correct, so hopefully they know who they're talking to.
it's Genna, right? Mengena?
Mengena, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I knew I was going to have a little bit of a slip up, but that's okay. That's part of
it's
our...
It's all right.
Get to know you process here. Daniel, mm-hmm. welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
First, a little bit of a bio. How did you become such a individual who understands money and the best things to do when it comes to when you have the finances?
Well, I made a lot of money very young. I actually had a lot of early success. And I had a lot of early success with the arrogance of youth and the lack of foresight to understand the importance of mentorship, of guidance. And so I promptly lost everything. I think I was a millionaire for about 8 months and then everything was gone. I was undeterred by that, went off and built another fortune up, and then that all got stolen because I trusted the wrong people. Rebuilding my life on the back of those two early losses, understanding the importance of seeking counsel, not opinions, which is something one of my mentors says, understanding the importance not only just of having the skills to create wealth, but also the mental resilience to keep it and the emotional relationship to it. That means that you can actually have an enjoyable relationship with money. We all have heard of, or at least know of, people who perhaps have been financially successful, and yet the life that they live against the backdrop of that financial success is far from successful. You know, whether we're talking about burnout, health issues, lack of healthy relationships, or just being bloody miserable, you know? And so a big part of my journey has been learning that very holistic approach to wealth and abundance, as I refer to the grand picture, and supporting people and bringing that into their lives, no matter where they are on the spectrum.
So what, where'd you get the idea to say, hey, I'm going to take my experiences, because I have been on the financial roller coaster. You said it so eloquently, where you've made the money, you've lost the money, you trusted the wrong people, but yet you have found a way to rebound and be able to regain financial stability, correct?
The second time that I lost everything was a bit of a hard knock. My TED Talk, which still has not been published, but it's out there on the waiting list to get published, it actually speaks about that. My TED Talk's actually called What Suicide Taught Me About Life. Because the second time that I lost everything, there was such a big smash and destruction to my sense of self that I actually went all the way into suicidal ideation. The only reason why I didn't actually take a swing at it was that I had such little self-esteem at the time that I thought that if I tried, I'm probably going to fail. And I didn't want to be a loser who couldn't even pull that off. And it was actually coming back from that journey and seeing after a few years of sort of rebuilding that all of those experiences that I went through did actually have something bigger to contribute. There were signs and synchronicities and so on and so forth. I left the business then that the third business that I built up successfully to a multi-seven figure a year business to do what I do now. And we built this up to multiple seven figure a year business. Mark Jackie said, I get to speak around the world, pre-COVID anyway. I get to write for some cool publications. I write for Entrepreneur Magazine. I've got two top ranking podcasts and get the opportunity to really take all of these experiences and pull meaning from them by getting to see the impact that those lessons have on other people and them not having to go through the same dark shadows I did.
And you said you did a TED Talk. Is that true?
Yes. I recorded it back in November, but then it was just before Thanksgiving. So everyone was off for Thanksgiving. Then everyone was off for Christmas. And so some people at the same thing they've been dripping them out, but we're just waiting for it to get posted to TED.com. But yeah, I'm really excited to share that part of my story with the world through the stage.
Yeah, and that's a fantastic platform to be able to kind of share, you know, your insight on that. And I'm excited to be able to kind of share your insight with our audience. Let's start off talking about money.
Sure.
To some of the people that you've had a chance to maybe interact with and talk with, the majority of them, how do they see money? What has been your experience with your conversations?
So there are two distinct groups that I get the opportunity to support, and both of them I want to bring to the middle. We have the people that perhaps have a life that they're quite happy with, you know, healthy body, family relationships, you know, kids are getting ready to go to college, whatever the thing is. And yet financially, they don't have the resources that they would like to have. And so we support them in having the financial element added to their life so they have a rounded, abundant life. The other distinct group that I speak to and work with are the ones that have got the financial success. You know, they've got the multi-six-figure career, or they've got a seven-figure business and beyond. And yet the cost of that money has been health of their body or health of the relationships. And so we bring those to the middle also. What I see with all of these is a loss of understanding that abundance is a holistic thing. It's not one-dimensional. Just because you've got money doesn't mean that you're well off. And just because you haven't got money doesn't mean that you're broke. But at the same time, money is a tool that facilitates most easily exchange in us having the choice to express ourselves as fully as we'd like to in the world. And so to say, I've got a happy family, I don't need money, is a little short-sighted and a little ludicrous, because money is a very, very powerful tool. You can't really go and pay the bills with fairy cakes and rainbow dust. You need dollar bills to do that. But it doesn't have to come at the expense of the happiness that you do have, the healthiness that you do have in your family. And I know a lot of people face fear that going down the route of wanting to have more money and wanting to have more choice, wanting to have more freedom and flexibility will cost. The same with those who have money. There's a fear that going down the path of developing yourself and opening up to healthy relationships, opening up to perhaps bringing other things into the mix, that they're not going to be able to enjoy the things that they want financially also. So it's just dispelling those myths and bringing everyone to the middle where they can have an abundant, joyful, purpose-driven life with enough money to express themselves as far as they'd like to without the cost.
So when you say in the middle, is a matter of having balance and balancing not only your earning potential, but also mm-hmm. making sure that you find happiness?
Exactly. I mean, one of the tools that we use is a teaching that I created called Money DNA. And what Money DNA does, and this is part of our secret sauce, is it actually supports you in finding the path to money coming to you with the most flow without the big expenditure of time and energy. And so we actually support people in creating access to that tool of money without burning out, without overextending, without costing you so much that you don't have, that you fall into an imbalance with the time and energy expenditure. So that's a big part of what supports us in being able to help people create that wealth and to access that wealth without the cost.
And is there an element in there where you try to have, where you maybe you coach folks to, it's okay to have the balance, but also make sure that you're always aware, as you know, one of the notes that you have here is that, you know, it's okay to have the money, but you know, maybe you might want to do things that are positive, whether it's take a trip to go somewhere, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. also, you know, kind of might be mindful of the money that you may spend.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate?
So I like to call it being mystically realistic in terms of your finances. And also we like to talk about magical money management, because managing your money doesn't mean that you have to be frugal to the point of not allowing yourself to get what you want, not allowing yourself to enjoy the things that you want. What we find a lot of the time is with the level of intentionality and awareness that we bring people to have with where they're at and what they want, you can actually find that a lot of people are actually spending money in places that they don't actually get anything back from. And as a result, not having the money to spend it in where they want. But when you can be really clear, these are the things that matter to me. These are the things that actually bring me joy. As an example, my family and I, you know, my wife and I, we like to travel. Travel's a big part. So we're not going to go and spend our money on something that doesn't bring us a return. We'll spend money on our travel, and therefore we'll travel very well. We tend to travel at least business or first class. We stay at very nice places. We enjoy those trips. But that money that goes into that doesn't go in vain. And because we're not sort of frivolously spending money in areas that don't mean anything to us, we have that money available. Also, because we know what we want, we can ensure that we take the steps in terms of the income that we create and the wealth that we create to ensure that we have the resources to fully express ourselves. But that does come to having a conscious relationship to where you're at, what you want, and what you're spending, and making sure that you're getting that emotional and mental return on what you're spending, rather than just spending for the sake of spending.
And what would be the, I mean, do you have any suggestions as to
to money management and being somebody, if you are able to build up that little bit of wealth and not to be frivolous, I mean, do you have any kind of tips to kind of make sure that you are getting the most out of anything you may do, and it goes for naught?
Well, there's a very powerful book called The Richest Man in Babylon, which was one of my earliest books on money management. And it uses allegoric tales based in ancient Babylon in order to teach money management. It's one of the most powerful ones I've come across. And one of the key ideas in there is, you know, putting aside before you go and do anything else. So when you get that paycheck, when you have that dividend, when you have that profit that you take from the business, put aside a piece of it first. And you'll actually find that putting it aside a piece of it first and putting it somewhere where it's a bit more difficult for you to just go and spend it. So, for example, I use a lot of cryptocurrency-based non-fiat spaces now because it's a bit more difficult to spend. I can't just go and take it out of the bank account. There's a bit of fiddling around in order to get it, or if I'm, you know, my precious metal reserves, it's more tricky to do that. So you'll find that when you put that percentage aside first, whether it's 5%, 10%, 15%, you don't miss it as much as you think that you're going to miss it when you put it aside first. But here's the magical sauce that goes on top of that. However much you put aside for the future, also put aside a portion for you to have some fun. If you're going to put aside 10%, put at least 5% into what we call a play jar. Go and have some fun with it. Keep a track on things that you love to do. Go and have date nights. Go and have a trip. Go and buy yourself something nice. Get a massage once a week. And the really cool thing is, it doesn't matter how much you're earning. Even if you're only allowed to put aside 10 bucks or 20 bucks, go and get yourself a nice cup of tea somewhere that you really like, or go and get a drink somewhere that you really love to go and have a drink and just enjoy something luxurious. But whatever you put aside first for yourself, that you're putting aside for the future, make sure that you're taking something out to enjoy life.
You know, hearing you say, you know, kind of give that explanation, it reminds me of, you know, some of my parents, my grandparents, especially my grandmother, who would say to me, you know, make sure you always put a couple of dollars away every paycheck, put that away. And then talking about maybe having even a little smaller amount. I fondly call it the GRF, the Guys Relief Fund, where if I want to go out and I want to go out and buy myself a toy, if I want to go out and get myself, you know, maybe I might want to update my laptop or get something else. I can do that because I have kind of tucked that away. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily, you know, if I don't use it after a while, I may take some of that and I may put it into, you know, my savings. You know, is that kind of what you're saying? Is this always kind of be saving?
Yeah. I mean, because the thing is, I don't actually refer to it as saving. I refer to it because I don't leave it passive. I always have it active. So I'm actually honoring the law of growth. I don't save for a rainy day because mentally then I'm asking for a rainy day to come. I'm honoring the natural law of growth. I'm thinking about the future. You know, I've got my 6-year-old stepdaughter, my 1-year-old son. You know, Ariana, in less than 10 years' time, is going to be wanting a lot more than Barbie dolls, right? You know, one of my older nephews just turned 17. He's learning to drive now. His parents are going to have to think about that in a year. He's going to be off to university. You know, there's things that need to be taken care of in the future. So I'm looking to that future and looking forward to ensuring that the resources are there to take care of it. But at the same time, I'm looking to today, and the person who has to keep their energy up, has to keep their morale up, has to keep their desire up to keep going and keep creating. And so having that pot that I can dip into and say, you know, my mate's coming down, for example, I live down in Cabo, my mate's coming down next week, we're going fishing. You know, there's a little pot there that I can go and make sure we get a nice boat and we're going to have a good time. And, you know, friends come down, we can go for dinners. I saw a nice pair of sneakers that I wanted the other day. I went ahead and got them. They weren't that cheap. My wife is Russian, so best believe that Christmas and birthdays aren't the cheapest thing. But the funds are there to take care of that, and it's been put aside, and it doesn't take away from my day-to-day expenditure. It doesn't take away from the long-term legacy building either.
You're just tuning in. We're fortunate to be speaking with Daniel Mangena. I think I said that right that time, right?
Yeah, you did. Got it. Thank you.
Daniel, of course, is a public speaker, best-selling author, broadcaster, and a coach, and he's giving us some insight. This is an individual who has built up his own wealth.
lost it, found a way to get it back. And he's sharing this information with us during these tough times. Now, I think from time to time, I have asked myself this question, and that is, how much do I need? If I'm able to collect this wealth, how much do I really need? How do I gauge what I really need?
Here's a really funny thing. So my signature coaching program is called Micro to Millions. And the whole premise of the program is that once you're in the program, we start an account at zero and we can take you all the way to 1.6 million if that's where you want to be. And the reason why I say is that where you want to be is because when I first started the program 3 or 4 years ago, I was like, everyone, let's go be millionaires. And it became very clear that a lot of people actually didn't want or need to be millionaires. Some people got to a few hundred thousand, whether it was to, you know, pay off the house, put some money in the college fund, and actually came to a nice cadence with their relationship to the program and to creating wealth. We even had one particular woman, she got to about $6,500. And she was like, Dan, I actually feel really good. So what do you mean? She goes, well, I found this little boat. And she's up in Canada, Victoria Island. She goes, well, I actually enjoy what I do with the painting. And well, I'm kind of just going to buy the boat. It's going to cost me about $100 a month to moor this boat. And I'm really happy. And so one of the things that I found on my journey is that everybody has a different place that they're going to be okay when it comes to the amount of money that they have. And it's imperative, and I don't use that word lightly, it's imperative that you build your own personal conscious relationship to what that figure is. That's what's going to keep you energized, right? Some people are burning out because they've gone beyond what they want or need, and there's not even any joy on the other side of it. And some people have, I'll give you another story. There's one woman called Andrea. She came into the program and was certain that she needed $100,000 a month to live her ideal lifestyle. And so we had this woman who has been stalling and not taking action in order to go and create the wealth that she wanted because she believed that she needed $1.2 million a year for her ideal lifestyle. Do you know what happened when I had to go away and actually write down everything that she wants and put some numbers to it? It was like $3,500 a month that she needed to live her ideal life. So she'd been in a stuck state thinking she needed, you know, six figures a month. Now she's making the money that she needed because she's able to start taking action because she just did the simple action. And this is the activity I want everyone to do. Design your ideal life, everything that you want to do, heart's content, and go and do some research, put some numbers to it. And you'll probably find it's a lot less than you want. And also just going down that list and interrogating it, asking yourself, do I really want a private jet? How often do I travel? Would I even travel on it? Do I really want a boat? Do I even go and rent a boat for the weekend now? Or is it that I'm honoring what I believe society thinks I should have? A lot of people are burning out because they're trying to do that. Have your own conscious relationship, have your own desires outlined, put some numbers to it, and you'll know exactly how much you need.
How important is it to set a clear goal and make sure it's an attainable goal?
I like, again, mystical realistic. One of my Danisms, a catchphrase I use, is push your edge and not your buttons. So being unrealistic is where big shifts happen, but being so unrealistic that you don't even believe that you're going to get there is where stuck state happens. And so find your goal. Our program uses a specific system of going through little steps. So we build up on smaller goals and increase the size of those goals that we're moving through. Break it down. If you've got a big goal, break it down and ask yourself, what's one step, one goal, an intermediary goal I can set between me and that big goal? And then you'll find that no matter how big your goal is, you can actually get there. The mind needs something to point to because it's a terminator always seeking an objective. But it doesn't have to be the final goal here and now. You can use intermediary goals so that you can actually keep hitting realistic steps on the way to perhaps something a bit more quote-unquote unrealistic.
So how do we convince ourselves that we are worth a financial abundance?
We can't really convince ourselves. We need to provide evidence for us to be convinced ourselves. The unconscious mind moves at 10,000 to 10 million times the speed of the conscious mind. By the time we've had an idea in our head that I am worthy, whatever the ongoing program is of unworthiness will have already played out 10,000 to 10 million times. But those programs don't come from nowhere. They come from the environment that we're holding. Again, this is one of the things I speak about in my TED talk. Our environment naturally leads to the unconscious thoughts that lead to the unconscious behaviors that lead to the outcomes that we have. So if we can start to set an environment up that supports the idea of being worthy, you'll find that the heavy lifting of changing your mind to be more worthy, changing your emotional state to one who accepts and acknowledges worthiness, will happen with a lot more flow.
So how if somebody is able to kind of set their mind to it? I mean, as we are both aware, is life, you know, life can change in a moment. Mm-hmm. You have all kinds of ups and downs. Mm-hmm. Hardships can come at a moment without notice. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate those and still keep your eyes on the prize?
Well, I think one of the first things to do is to acknowledge that those ups and downs are going to come, instead of being unrealistic and thinking that there's some kind of magic fairy dust you can use to stop that happening. Mm-hmm. Life is full of contrast. It's full of ups and downs. It's full of bumps and so on and so on. That's part of life. It's part of the human experience. We're never going to be happy all the time. We're never going to be switched on all the time. It's one of the things I speak about in my book, Stepping Beyond Intention, the idea of being compassionate with the fact that we are humans having a human experience. There's a lot of... I consider them to be snake oil salespeople that run around saying, oh, you're going to be happy all the time and everything's going to be fairy dust all the time. And, you know, if you just take this course, you're going to be mystically happy. That's not what it is. But we can resource ourselves. Just having that awareness of the fact that, okay, there's going to be down days. All right, well, how do you need to be resourced to deal with those down days? So, for example, for me, I've got time worked into my day every day for me to have time for myself to recuperate. I had a meditation time before we hopped on to have this interview. I set that time aside. I know what nourishes me, and I ensure that my life is populated with times in my week, times in my day that nourish me. I know what my trigger points are, and I make sure that I limit the opportunity for those trigger points to have space to come and negatively impact me on my day-to-day life. I'm ruthless in terms of curating the people, places, and things that I spend my time and energy. Right, I don't have friends just for the sake of having friends. There's friends that I have healthy relationships with that we nourish each other. I don't care how long I've known you. If we're not adding to each other's lives, then there's no point in us being in each other's lives. And that's not always an easy choice to make. But if you want to have a healthy life, it's going to mean, you know, making choices to have healthy people, places, and things in it.
Fantastic words to live by, because too many times I've crossed paths with people who, you know, who are all about the drama. And mm-hmm. that's not conducive to a positive life.
Nope.
And making positive steps forward into mm-hmm. changing your life. Never mind trying to, you know, be all you can be financially. So
exactly.
Daniel, I got to thank you so much for joining us. We got a couple of more minutes left here. Mm-hmm. I want to give folks an opportunity. Maybe they just got a little bit of an appetizer with our conversation, but you actually have other avenues. If folks want to hear more, and they want to be enlightened further, you do podcasts, do you not?
Yes, I do. I do. I think the best thing to do is to head over to dreamwithdan.com. Really easy to remember, dreamwithdan.com. That's my website. Both my podcasts are on there. I blog quite regularly. The articles I write for Entrepreneur and other publications are on there. And I've got some free resources on there as well that people can get. Often doing little free events and, you know, virtual experiences that people can come along to from the comfort of their own home. But that's all available on the website. It's the easiest way to find out everything.
And is there anything that I haven't asked you, or is there maybe one other small nugget of information that'll help complete at least our conversation today?
I think it just goes back to remembering that life is to be lived. And if it's not lived in an enjoyable fashion, then what was the point? So, you know, these are all very serious things. We've got serious times, inflation, political unrest, COVID-19, a lot happening. Take as much time as you can to inject some joy into your life and make that something that's at the top of your to-do list. Otherwise, what's the point?
So I would ask you, are you someone who probably navigates away from social media and keeps yourself free of it? Or do you only do it in small doses?
I just curate my feed. You know, I don't have negative Nancys. And if you're a negative Nancy, you'll be muted or you'll be unfollowed. It's as simple as that. Every single input that we allow into our experience has an impact on who we are and what's going on in our mind. Like I said, 10,000 to 10 million times the speed of the conscious mind. Every single thing is going to be disrupting or supporting what's going on in that program. And so I'm ruthless in curating what goes into that. So I don't run away from social media. I use it as a positive tool to uplift myself, to educate myself, to connect with others. But I don't allow it to be something that detracts from my experience at all.
And we have been privileged to speak with Daniel Mangenin. And he is not only a public speaker, but he's a best-selling author, as we were telling you, Stepping Beyond Intention. Also, seek out his podcast for more information. But Daniel, thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute honor to chat with you today.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is our show. I want to thank you all for joining me here. Let's all agree to reconvene next week at 6:15 p.m. for yet another Monday Night Talk Show. Have a good evening.